right, so ready to unpack a case where workers' rights and civil rights, well, they kind of clash head-on.
Definitely sounds fascinating.
We're looking at Emporium Capital Covey Western Edition Community Organization. It's a Supreme Court decision from 1975, but it really still resonates today.
Absolutely, yeah. It throws a spotlight on the tension between, the right to bargain collectively and the fight against racial discrimination.
You've got your union, a company facing accusations of discrimination, and workers stuck right in the middle.
Yeah, it's a real tangled web.
It really is. So we're talking about Emporium Capwell, a department store in San Francisco, and two black employees, James Hollins and Tom Hawkins. They felt like the company had some discriminatory practices, especially around promotions and assignments.
And the thing is, there was already a collective bargaining agreement set up between the company and the union.
Oh, so that should have covered everything, right?
Well, in theory, this agreement actually specifically prohibited discrimination and even had a grievance procedure outlined.
So what went wrong?
Well, Hollins and Hawkins tried working through the union's process, but they weren't satisfied. They felt like the union wasn't really going to bat for them.
I can see how they might feel that way, for sure. Imagine feeling like the system meant to protect you isn't really on your side.
Exactly.
So they decided to try a different tactic. They wanted to take their grievances straight to the company president, bypassing the union structure entirely.
So they organized pickets, held press conferences, and basically made a lot of noise to raise public awareness about their situation.
And this was happening during a pretty pivotal time in history, right? I mean, the civil rights movement was still very much alive, and there was a big push for action on racial injustice.
Absolutely. Hollins and Hawkins were definitely tapping into that energy and momentum.
But of course, the company wasn't exactly thrilled with this whole public pressure campaign, right?
No, they weren't, and ended up firing both Hollins and Hawkins. They claimed that going outside the established procedures was a violation of the collective bargaining agreement.
So then the Western Edition Community Organization got involved, right, to support the fired employees.
Right, they took the case to the National Labor Relations Board, the NLRB.
You'd think the NLRB, being all about protecting workers' rights, would side with the employees.
You would, but that's where this case takes a really interesting turn. The NLRB actually ended up siding with the company.
Wow, a real curveball.
They basically said that even though the employees were protesting alleged racial discrimination, what they did wasn't protected under the National Labor Relations Act.
So even though they were raising concerns about discrimination, they weren't shielded by the law that governs labor relations.
Exactly. It brings up this really crucial legal question. Could these workers bypass their union to fight discrimination, or did they absolutely have to operate within the existing framework?
Even if they felt it wasn't working for them. That's a tough one. And of course, this question is what ultimately sent the case all the way up to the Supreme Court.
Right to the top.
And the Supreme Court was actually pretty divided on this one, but ultimately, in an 8-1 decision, they sided with the company.
Their main argument was that allowing individual workers to negotiate directly with employers would really weaken the whole system of collective bargaining.
So they were basically saying, stick to the established procedures.
Right, but it's important to note that the court wasn't saying discrimination was okay. Their focus was on the process, on following the rules.
Like, they believed the National Labor Relations Act was designed to channel all those complaints through the union, keeping the union as that sole representative of the workers.
Precisely.
But they also made it clear that unions have a legal duty to represent all their members fairly, including minorities.
Right, that's that crucial concept of duty of fair representation.
So they were kind of saying, look, the union have to do its part too.
Yes, and if the union isn't upholding that duty, the court suggested workers could explore other legal options.
Okay, so the system has to work both ways. And then there's that fascinating dissent from Justice Douglas, right?
Yes, his dissent is really intriguing. Sadly, we don't have his full reasoning on record, but we know he felt very strongly that workers shouldn't be stuck with potentially ineffective union processes when their civil rights are at stake.
That's a powerful stance, and it raises such essential questions about the balance between collective action and individual rights.
Definitely.
So we have this landmark case, a divided court, a dissenting voice, and ultimately, a lot of food for thought about how we approach diversity, equity, and inclusion in the workplace, especially within organized labor.
It really lays the groundwork for so many of the conversations we're still having today. So we've been really digging deep into this Emporium Capwell case. And, it makes you think about how much has changed since 1975, but also how much hasn't when it comes to these issues.
Yeah, it's like we're holding up this legal mirror to see how we've been grappling with diversity, equity, inclusion, all that, especially within the context of organized labor.
It really does, and I think what's so interesting is how the case forces us to look at the traditional union model, both its strengths and its while maybe potential weaknesses.
Right, because on one hand, unions have this incredible history of fighting for workers' rights, you know, pushing for fair wages, safe conditions, protection from unfair treatment by employers.
Absolutely, tons of positive impact there.
But then Emporium Capwell, it kind of exposes this possible crack in that foundation. You know, what happens when those protections, the ones that are negotiated through collective bargaining, don't really address the specific needs and concerns of minority groups within the workforce?
It's a really, really tough question and something the court grappled with, too. They really emphasized maintaining that union's role, you know, as the exclusive representative of all the workers. The argument was that letting individuals or even smaller groups negotiate separately would weaken the union's power and could lead to chaos in the workplace.
It's like that saying, united we stand, divided we fall. But what if some of the folks in that united group feel like, well, they're not being heard or their concerns aren't being taken seriously?
You've hit on the core tension there, and it's what makes this case so fascinating. The court recognized how important it is to combat discrimination, but ultimately they prioritized the procedural framework, that collective bargaining structure, over the immediate needs of those workers who were alleging discrimination.
Okay, so the process was kind of paramount, even if individuals felt like it wasn't working for them.
Yeah, and it really makes you wonder, in the years since Emporium Capwell, you know, how has this tension between individual rights and collective bargaining played out? Have things actually changed?
Well, one big shift I've noticed is this growing emphasis on DEI initiatives. Right, both within workplaces and within unions themselves.
Definitely. A lot of organizations now have whole departments or committees devoted to promoting diversity, equity, and inclusion.
It seems like it's become this core values for a lot of companies, not just a legal box to check, but something they see as really important for attracting and keeping talent.
And that shift has definitely impacted the labor movement, too. Unions are becoming much more proactive in addressing racial and social justice issues, both within their own ranks and in their broader advocacy.
We've seen this play out in some recent labor disputes, haven't we? Like teachers' unions pushing for social justice issues during contract negotiations?
Exactly. Things like more equitable funding for schools in underserved communities, addressing racial bias in disciplinary actions. Those are great examples of how the conversation has evolved since Emporium Capwell. Unions are recognizing that their responsibility goes beyond just wages and benefits, you know? It's about being active in the fight for social and economic justice.
It's like broadening the scope of what unions are fighting for.
Exactly. But it also brings up new challenges. Right? How do unions balance the needs of a diverse membership while still maintaining that united front when they're negotiating?
It feels like a tightrope walk, trying to address those specific concerns of different groups while still working towards those shared goals that benefit everyone. It reminds me of that whole debate around identity politics.
It's a complex issue, and I don't think there are any easy answers, but Emporium Capwell, it gives us this framework, a way to think about the legal and ethical considerations. It pushes us to ask these tough questions about how we balance individual rights and the power of collective action.
And it also makes you think about the role of the legal system in all of this, right? If those traditional union grievance procedures aren't always enough, what other options do workers have? Especially when it comes to tackling systemic discrimination.
That's where things get even more interesting, especially when you layer in the rise of new technologies and the changing nature of work itself. Take the gig economy, for example. Workers there often didn't have traditional union representation. How do we protect their rights, especially when it comes to things like discrimination?
And then you have this increasing reliance on algorithms and hiring and promotion decisions. Could those even be challenged through traditional union processes? I don't know.
It's uncharted territory in a lot of ways and really builds on the legacy of Emporium Capwell. These issues force us to confront those evolving dynamics in the workplace head on.
And we're back for this final part of our deep dive into Emporium Capwell. We've been looking at this landmark case, its historical significance, and really how it's still shaping conversations about workers' rights and the fight for equality in the workplace, even today.
Yeah, and as we kind of wrap things up here, I think it's crucial to really look ahead, you know, to the future. The world of work is transforming so rapidly. Technology is playing such a central role. It makes you wonder, how do those lessons from Emporium Capwell, how do they apply in this 21st century context?
Right, because it does feel like we're standing at the edge of something brand new. All this talk about automation, artificial intelligence, the gig economy. It's like the whole definition of work is being totally redefined. So how does all that impact the traditional frameworks? You know, labor law, collective bargaining, are those even relevant anymore?
That's the million-dollar question, isn't it? Because at its core, Emporium Capwell was all about finding that balance, that delicate balance between individual rights and collective power. But what happens when those traditional structures of collective bargaining, the unions, the agreements, what happens when those start to break down?
Well, it's already happening, right? In the gig economy, workers are often classified as independent contractors. They don't get those same protections. They don't have access to traditional union representation. How do we make sure those workers aren't left behind?
It's a valid concern, absolutely. And even for workers in more traditional jobs, you know, the rise of automation, AI, it's creating a lot of anxiety. If a robot can do your job, what leverage do you really have?
Right. It's a whole different playing field now. So how do we take those principles from Emporium Capwell, you know, that balancing act of individual rights and collective power, how do we apply those to this new landscape? How do we even begin to think about that?
Well, I think one of the key takeaways from Emporium Capwell is that we need those clear legal frameworks, but they have to be adaptable. You know, in their decision, the court was really focused on upholding that existing system, that collective bargaining structure. But they also recognize that there needs to be some flexibility and that sometimes addressing discrimination might require looking at other legal avenues.
So it's not just about clinging to the old ways, right? It's about taking those core principles and finding ways to make them work in this new context in ways that actually benefit people.
Exactly. And I think the focus has to be on guaranteeing those avenues for workers, no matter their employment status, no matter their industry. They need ways to raise concerns, to address grievances, to protect their rights. And that includes protection against discrimination. That can't be an afterthought. It needs to be built into the system from the ground up.
It's almost like we need to reimagine what collective action even looks like in the 21st century. Maybe it won't always involve those traditional unions, but it's still about finding ways for workers to come together, to organize, and fight for their interests.
I think you're spot on there. We're already seeing those new models emerging, those worker centers, online platforms for organizing, even new forms of digital activism. It's about harnessing technology to connect workers, build solidarity, give them a stronger voice.
And it's about recognizing that the fight for equality in the workplace, it's not a one-and-done thing, right? It's an ongoing process. It's constantly evolving. We have to challenge those old assumptions, adapt to new obstacles, and get creative about upholding those principles of fairness and justice.
Couldn't agree more. You know, Emporium Capwell, even though it's a product of a very specific time, it gives us this lens, a way to understand the ongoing tension between individual rights and collective power. And as we navigate the complexities of the modern workplace, those tensions are only going to intensify.
So as we wrap up here, what's the big takeaway for our listeners? What should they be thinking about as they encounter these issues, you know, in their own workplaces, their communities? What can they do?
I think the main message is that this fight for workplace equality, it's a marathon. It's not a sprint. It demands vigilance. It demands creativity. And it demands that we be willing to challenge the status quo. Emporium Capwell is a great reminder that those legal frameworks, those are essential, but they can only take us so far. You have to be active participants in shaping the future of work, and we have to make sure it's a future where all workers have the chance to thrive, regardless of their background or identity.
That's a powerful message. And this has been a truly fascinating, thought-provoking deep dive. I really appreciate you taking the time to share your expertise with us.
It's been my pleasure. I'm so passionate about these issues, and I hope our conversation today will encourage our listeners to think critically about the challenges and the opportunities that lie ahead as we continue working towards a more just and equitable workplace for everyone.
And that concludes our deep dive into Emporium Capwell Covey Western Edition Community Organization. We hope you found it informative and engaging. Until next time, keep learning, keep questioning, and keep pushing for a better future of work for all. 2CCN.